Welcome to Banfield. The search for Gabby Petito tragically appears to be over, while the hunt for her fiancé has only intensified. Today, Brian Laundrie's parents were led out of that home, their home, which has now been roped off officially as a crime scene. Officers were armed with a search warrant, and in it, it turns out they've confiscated a hard drive believed to be connected to Gabby's disappearance and now possible murder. On September 1st, Laundrie returned home after a long cross-country road trip. He was driving Gabby's now infamous white van, but Gabby wasn't with him. He lawyered up almost immediately, refusing to answer questions about her whereabouts, frustrating Gabby's family and the police. Sadly, yesterday it appears those questions were answered when human remains were found in Grand Teton National Park in Wyoming, which the FBI said were consistent with Petito. It is the same place where Gabby FaceTimed with her family for the final time. No cause of death has been reported yet. Authorities say a full forensic identification is being conducted. Weeks ago, after Brian returned to Florida, his parents wouldn't make him available to the police for questioning. But then on Friday of last week, they claimed he went hiking. Tuesday, 4 days prior, at a place called Miyakahatchee Creek Environmental Park in Northport, Florida. The park is an alligator-infested 160-acre heavily wooded area that's known for its trails and its gators. Police say the 50-man search involved drones and bloodhounds and canines and four-wheelers, but it yielded no results. And police now say they are done there, can't find them there. So the big question remains tonight, where do you look next? Where is Brian Laundrie? I'm joined now by News Nation's Brian Enten, who is outside the family house in Northport, Florida, right in front of that curious camper van that the FBI agents combed through today. So, Brian, take me through the day at that property.
Yeah, this was wild, Ashley. You know, we had a feeling late last night that this was going to happen because suddenly police came in, shut down the roads, put police tape around everything, and we knew something was about to happen. We thought it might happen overnight. It didn't happen. It happened after 9 o'clock this morning. Suddenly, a van and FBI cars roll up. 24 FBI agents get out of the van and the cars. They went into the house. They were allowed in. The parents opened the door and let them in, and they took out a lot of stuff. We don't know what it was, but there was a lot of it. Boxes and boxes and boxes of evidence. It was pouring rain as all of this went on. We were right in position right here. Let me show you. We had this view. They basically backed the van right up here to the garage so that all the stuff wouldn't get wet. And then they unloaded all of these boxes of evidence. 5 or 6 hours after they got here, they were gone.
So, Brian, just we missed a bit of what you were showing to us, but I can see that perhaps it was the garage door that was open and they were bringing those boxes out through the garage door. That's why there was that little piece of video that we could see boxes going back between. But the camper van, did they bring anything out of the camper van?
They didn't bring anything out of the camper van, but they finally searched the camper van. A lot of people have been focused on this camper, wondering, could he be inside? We never saw anyone search it until today. The FBI went inside the camper. And right next to the camper where you see that truck, there was also a silver Mustang. A lot of attention on the Mustang because it's believed that Brian may have driven that Mustang to the reserve when he allegedly went hiking. They towed that Mustang away, the FBI. That is now also part of the evidence.
So curious, if he drove that silver Mustang to the nature reserve and then his parents say he never came back, how did the silver Mustang get back to that property to be towed away by the FBI today?
Okay, this is strange, and let me break it down for you. According to the police, the Laundries, the parents who, by the way, happen to still be inside this house behind me, say that Brian Laundrie left in the silver Mustang on Tuesday and drove to the reserve to go hiking. They claim that on Wednesday or Thursday, they realized that he hadn't come back and that they went to go pick up the Mustang and they drove it back here to the house. We noticed when the Mustang reappeared here at the house. But what's so strange is if their son was missing in the wildlife reserve where he went hiking, Why would they then go get the Mustang, bring it back to the house, still not tell police until Friday, and then they call police on Friday and say, our son is missing?
And we are all supposed to believe them when they point us in the direction of the Miyakachi Creek Park and then spend all of this time and money searching for Brian in an alligator-infested place that's dangerous for searchers. We're supposed to believe those people?
Listen, I mean, we asked police that very question. We asked them at a news conference, are the parents possibly leading you in the wrong direction? And they said, we are working to corroborate their story. They did not say we believe the parents or we know for sure that Brian was hiking in this reserve. They said they were working to corroborate the story. And then next thing we know, they searched 2 days, a 24,000-acre preserve, by the way, search a very small area for 2 days and then say, we're done here.
Okay, so, I mean, my spidey senses are saying obstruction of justice here. If they have sent the police off on a wild goose chase to a dangerous place with all of these agents and all of the assets that they brought in there. Just quickly, you just mentioned that those parents are back in that crime scene. That whole house is roped off behind you. I can see the yellow tape, but they were allowed to go back in.
Yeah, let me kind of walk you around real quick, Ashley. So you've got the house here, the garage where they took the evidence out. You see the yellow tape. We're on a neighbor's private property, so we're allowed to be here. But they've literally got this entire house surrounded by crime scene tape, and they are now sleeping in the house in the middle of the crime scene tape. We were very interested to see what was going to happen with them today. When they got pulled into that black van, we thought, perhaps they're going to be taken away. They were only in the black van for a very short time, and then the agents took them back into the house where they are tonight.
So just a quick little sit out in the black van while the agents did something they didn't want the parents to see, clearly. So one quick question for you, and I've asked you this a few times, but it takes on a whole new light today. And that is that you were there, Brian, on Tuesday of last week, right through Friday, doing effectively surveillance, in which you said it didn't even appear anyone was in that house, let alone Brian, you know, laundry being spirited out or the Mustang coming back, etc. But at any point, did you see those parents come out and do anything about that Mustang? Or did you see them come out and drive off? I'm just wondering, possibly out of the garage, maybe with a Brian laundry in their trunk.
We did not. The interesting thing is when we got here on Tuesday, and remember, Tuesday, this wasn't the story that it is now. So we rolled up on Tuesday and decided we're going to sit on this house. Tuesday, there was no Mustang here. We didn't know anything about the Mustang. We stayed here for most of the day and night, left for a short time, came back Wednesday. That's when the Mustang appeared. So that's what we know about the Mustang.
Can you show
me? We had never set our eyes on Brian Laundry.
Just like point out behind that camper and give me a rough idea of where that Mustang was parked and if it would have been easy to sort of get a person into the trunk or what. Like where in relation to that camper was it?
Yeah, the Mustang was right on the other side of the camper here. It was parked right on the other side. You see the garage here, which was interesting. The garage door had never opened since we've been here for a week. It opened today when they brought the evidence out. But the Mustang was on the other side. Then we wondered, we know this is the dad's sort of cranberry red truck, pickup truck. We've seen the dad come and go in that. They had two tow trucks here. They first towed the Mustang. I said to my photographer, Luis, I said, I bet they're going to tow this pickup truck next. But they didn't. The pickup truck remains here tonight.
I just can't understand. If you were doing all the surveillance, where were the police to keep an eye on the front, back, and every window? Brian Enten, excellent work out there. Thank you, my friend. I appreciate all of that. I'm going to turn from Brian Enten right now, and I'm going to talk to somebody who knows all about finding people who don't want to be found. He's basically made his life's passion and work on that. He's the host of Investigation Discovery's In Pursuit with John Walsh. In just 3 seasons, John has helped capture 26 fugitives and find 8 missing children and about 1,400 throughout his career. The question, he's not officially a fugitive. He's not officially charged. But John Walsh, do you think you might be able to help catch number 27, Brian Laundry?
Well, that's the reason I'm talking to you, Ashley, and it's a pleasure to talk to you. You used to work for me, one of the best reporters I ever had, and wish you well on your new gig. But I've always said, and I've been saying it for days, this is a homicide. this dirtbag is out there. I don't know how he got out of the house with the FBI and local cops watching him day and night. And, you know, this semantic BS about person of interest. In the old days, we used to call it the suspect. Now, there's only one suspect. There were no other persons of interest, no other suspects. How did he get out? How did the FBI and the local cops let the main suspect get away? All I had to do is put a deputy sheriff in the front street, a deputy sheriff in the back street. They wouldn't have had to search a swamp. And what the family is doing to Gabby's family, what Brian's family, the dirty laundries, and believe me, they are dirty, when they haven't cooperated. This girl used to live in their house. She was engaged to their son. Their son meandered back from a 4-month trip and parked a Winnebago, her Winnebago, not his, her van, not Winnebago, her van in the driveway for 10 days. So he had 10 days to scrub that. I don't know what the hell the FBI waited so long to get in there, but he had 10 days to clean the house out. He had 10 days to scrub the van. And then finally, the parents went, how could Brian not tell us that he didn't bring her home? How did his parents, how did the dirty laundries not have the guts to tell us? So they filed a missing persons report, and then they clam up. He lawyers up, they clam up. And think of the gall of this. Last Friday, their famous Johnny Cochran-style lawyer, Bertolino, calls the police and says, oh, the Landrys want to help you out now. On Tuesday, Brian went to a swamp that was nearby, and we were so worried about him that we went and found the car and put a note in it and said, dear Brian, don't hurt yourself. And then we brought the car back ourselves on Thursday, and then we called you on Friday. We didn't help you at all in the beginning, but now Brian's gone. Well, you know what they did? They bought their son 4 extra days. They bought him 4 days to get a head start. So this Wednesday night, I'm going to focus in on Brian. He's going to be the top of the show on In Pursuit. And as you said, Ashley, I know one thing all these years. Lots of people don't want to call the cops. They don't want to call the FBI. They don't want to get dragged into a trial. They don't want an FBI agent knocking on their front door or a U.S. attorney saying, we need you to help us convict this guy. Everybody in America knows one thing. Call me or text me. I don't trace or tap phones. I don't care who you are, whether you're legal or illegal, you're a gangbanger, whatever. There'll be no revenge, no retribution. Nobody know you called. So call me. I'm saddling up to catch this dirtbag.
Okay, over the break, I want you to dig up the phone number, and we'll get that out there to our viewers, John, so that if anyone out there is watching, they will call you, and hopefully we can, you know, get another caller under your belt there. After the break, John, I also want to ask you, and I kind of know the answer, but it's the trust factor. Why would anyone have trusted what these parents said after they gave him what we think might have been a 4-day lead time escape, if that's what's happened, and maybe longer, because who knows if Brian Laundrie was even in that house on Tuesday packing a camping backpack to go to that park. So when we come back, I'm going to go through all of that and a couple of other questions right back after the break with the inimitable John Walsh. With Brian Laundrie on the run, the best person to talk to is the man who has spent his almost entire career finding people on the run, and that's John Walsh, the host of In Pursuit, which airs on Investigation Discovery and Discovery Streaming. John, I am so glad to talk to you at this particular time because it seems the whole country is just absolutely wrapped in this particular case. Why do you think the police believed the Laundrie parents when they said 4 days ago we went on a hike, but a day after that, they went and got his car, never said a word to them, possibly giving giving Brian 4 days lead time to make a run for it, or possibly giving him a full week if he was never in that house to begin with. If on September 11th, when she was reported missing, he took off. Why would the police believe these parents?
It's beyond me, because the number one thing police do is they're suspicious of what people tell them. So I can't figure that out. But I've got to say one thing. This is a whole trilogy of sad things that shouldn't have happened. Number one, that 911 call that we heard yesterday, had that 911 caller that took the call, that wonderful tourist was going through that town and saw Gabby and Brian, And he felt bad enough to pull over and call the 911 operator and say to him, I just saw a guy beating a girl on the street. I pulled up behind him and pulled next to him, and I saw this same guy beating her on the front seat of the car. That was never translated to the two deputies that pulled him over. He had total control of her, classic domestic abuser, and she was scared to death and crying. This girl weighs 100 pounds. She was terrified. And these two poor cops didn't get the intel from the 911 operator that he was the aggressor. He told them a bullshit story that her phone, she dinged him on the face because you could see him. He was controlling the whole thing. And I watched that 911 call today and that interview, cop cam interview, and I went, she's terrified. Can't they tell she's crying? She's shaking. He's right there. He's the bad guy. And in their report, they wrote that he was the victim and let them go. I can only imagine.
Isn't
she might
just
be alive.
Just
she might have been
so
alive.
Weird.
It's just so sad. It's so sad.
And
then
something?
The cops fall for this Bertolino lawyer. They fall for this lawyer who's BSing them the whole time. Oh, Brian's in here. Brian's here. The parents don't need to cooperate because it's Fifth Amendment. I get all that. But he's not just a person of interest. From day one, everyone in this country felt the same way I did a week ago or 5 days ago, that he was the perpetrator and she's probably dead in the desert. That's what the odds are. And that's exactly what happened. And they buy this ruse that Tuesday he went to the swamp. It gave him 4 more days to get ahead. And I'll tell you what, at some point, these parents are going to have to pay. They're going to have to pay for being an accessory for putting him on the run. And they better not help him because, now these days.
I think it's obstruction of justice if this turns out to be a big ruse. But then again, I'm still shocked that they didn't have probable cause to just go into that house last week. The man was driving a missing woman's van. To me, that's probable cause. Get a warrant. Go in. Don't knock. Just go in. There's a woman missing and there's exigent circumstances. I want to play that 911 call, John, that you just talked about, because I think it is extremely telling. I had to rewind it, listen to it again, thinking I misheard it, because the police report said she was slapping him. She was hitting him. But now we can hear from the witness who called 911. And this is how the witness described it to the 911 operator. Have a listen.
We drove by and the gentleman was slapping the girl.
He was slapping her?
Yes. And then we stopped. They ran up and down the sidewalk. He proceeded to hit her, hopped in the car, and they drove off.
Okay, you said it's a white van?
White van, I give you the license plate if you give me one sec.
So that was a complete boondoggle, because clearly he was a dangerous person. And by the way, John, did you hear also that in that material that came from the hard drive, it was determined that the messaging and phone calls between Gabby and her mom, they were growing increasingly panic-stricken, meaning that Gabby was becoming more stressed about her relationship with each and every communication with her mother. That is just so distressing.
Well, I'll tell you, it's sad. I don't want to knock 911 operators. They're always busy. They're dealing with life and death every day. But how didn't that be related to those two deputy sheriffs that pulled him over? He created the whole scenario that he was the victim. And there she's shaking and crying and scared to death, etc. Like every abuser of women in this country does, they terrify them and the women don't leave and they wind up dead. Well, that's exactly what happened to Gabby. The real sad thing is that they didn't relay that information that he was the guy slapping her, that he punched her when she got in the car. She was the one in danger. And I'll tell you what, there's been so many red herrings by this guy. Texting on her phone that they can't get any service in Yosemite. That's the first tip that it's a red herring, that she's not with the guy. And then he started sending texts, I need to talk to grandpa, a name that he never used before. He didn't know the nickname of her grandfather. So right away, but I'll say this, Ashley, I don't think there's a judge in this country, if I went to him and said, Here's a guy that's been holed up in his house with his without his fiance after a 4-month trip for 10 days. He never let her parents that she didn't know that she didn't come back with them. The parents had to file a missing persons report. They lawyer up and lie to the cops repeatedly. But I would have gone to a judge and say, Judge, this guy's not just a person of interest. He's the main suspect. Something bad happened to this girl. We need to get in the house now, not today. Not a week later, a week ago, when they get in there, because he had a chance to scrub that van. He's no dummy. He looks like a real dumb redneck, but he's no dummy. He scrubbed that van and he cleaned that house out. So they didn't get much today. And I don't know why they didn't go to a judge, because I don't think there's a judge that would have turned him down. I think a judge went, you know what? Search the van and get in that house. So
yeah, the
whole thing's been a nightmare.
Just a calamity. But we're going to go to break. But I do want to say, put up on the screen, if you will, the message. I'm going to ask the control room just before we go to break. It was the message that the parents got on August 27th saying, can you help Stan? I just keep getting his voicemails and missed calls. And when you see that, Stan is her grandfather. And her mother says she never would have called her grandfather by his name, Stan. So she believes that that was a lie. I don't know if we have that message that her parents marked in the, it came out in the affidavit today, that message, that text just was not something that her parents believed for a minute was hers, August 27th. So it gives us a bit of a time frame. John, we're going to work on that little piece of digital information that is getting stuck in our gremlins. But in the meantime, after the break, yep, I want to ask you about a huge development today. And that was one of our correspondents out at the Grand Teton Park entrance saw the coroner van come back and spend the whole day back at the scene where they had already recovered the remains. I'm going to ask you what your thoughts are about that, what it might mean for the investigation, what it might mean for the condition of Gabby's body, which, of course, that matters for a trial. We'll be back right after this with John Walsh. Welcome back to Banfield. Joining me is John Walsh, the host of In Pursuit with John Walsh. It airs on Investigation Discovery on Wednesdays. It also streams on Discovery Live, and it's a great show. You do great work, John Walsh. I have always said that about you. We've got so many bad guys off the street because of your commitment to justice. So in this case, do you have any thoughts on the reporting that came from Marcos Ortiz, who works with us? He's out at the Grand Teton entrance to the park area, the campground area where Gabby's remains presumably were recovered. That coroner came back today and spent the day there. What does that tell you about this scene?
Well, it tells you two things. As you mentioned, they took her body away. So they got the pathologists on the plane today, the forensic pathologists, and they're going to do that autopsy during the night tonight, probably, and most of tomorrow. But he went back to the scene because they overlook all kinds of things. I remember, I think you worked with me during the days of Chandra Levy, where that crime scene was invaded by reporters so much,
yes,
that they missed three of her ribs. Her ribs were in the park. They're going to go back and really cover that. They might find something in the dirt, in the sand. They might find a piece of something that he used, if he used a weapon. They need to cover that thoroughly. It's still an active crime scene. And, of course, the sad thing is she's been out there and exposed, and probably animals have been after her. I'm hoping that there's enough of her left that they can get a good read on how he killed her. That would be very, very important. But you know,
that Chandra Levy story was in August of 2001. I remember that well. It was right before 9/11, yep, that Gary Condit was under the microscope. Good memory, John. So, and I will say that, yep, a photographer was in that area, saw grizzly prints, saw evidence of grizzly. So there is a potential that that is a very compromised body or scene. I just want to ask you, yep, to look at this picture with me, John. Gabby's dad posted on social media a picture of Gabby with the image behind her of the angel wings. And it was just, you know, it was such a heartfelt image that he posted, knowing what he knows now. I wanted to ask you, as someone who has been through this, who has had a missing child, who has had the worst news with your son, Adam, what would you say to Gabby's parents tonight?
Several things. And as you mentioned, they have joined this horrible club that my wife and I belong to, the parents of murdered children. But I look at it as Adam, this beautiful six-year-old boy, is my angel. He's my motivation. We wanted to make sure Adam didn't die in vain. And now Gabby is his angel, his whole family's angel. And she was a beautiful girl, and she was killed by a horrible coward. But I would say to this, the whole country is praying for you. The whole country is in anguish for you. And the best way, I say, for parents of murdered children to deal with things is first get justice. There's no such thing as closure. He'll always have a big chunk out of his heart. That whole family will. There's no closure. It's justice. They need justice. Remember all the good things about Gabby. Remember all the wonderful. Don't celebrate or think about. I don't celebrate. Don't dwell on the one day, horrible day in your life, in her life. Think about what joy she brought to you as a family. And I'm going to do the best I can, and lots of other Americans, to make sure you get justice for Gabby.
John, let's put up your number so that if anyone's watching right now, they can call your number as well. It's right there, 1-833-378-7783. As John said, the callers can remain anonymous. I'm going to repeat it, 1-833-378-7783. John, you do the Lord's work. Thank you, sir, for being on tonight. And I hope we can talk again and certainly continue to cover this case together. Thank you, John Walsh.
Thanks for having me. And let's pray I catch that, or somebody catches that guy. Go to my website, call my hotline. Ashley, you worked for me for years and did great, great work. We need to catch this guy before he kills somebody else.
Well, he certainly would be desperate if he's on the run right now. I'm going to remind everybody, John, your show In Pursuit with John Walsh airs Wednesdays on Investigation Discovery, also streams on Discovery Plus. Thank you so much. I'm going to turn gears now to that other big story, the Murdoch saga. It reads like a John Grisham novel, with murderers and a hired hitman. And now, yeah, I do have something new. A newly uncovered arson connected to this man. There is a Lowcountry lawyer who's connected to it all. If Alex Murdoch allegedly siphoned the millions from his law firm that we also heard about and his clients, well, how on earth did he pull it off? Because judges have to sign off on that. Our next guests, well, they say they have figured it out. They're going to share it with you next. Murder, conspiracy, a hitman, and arson. Man, oh man, that's a lot to digest, because that's new information in the Murdoch saga. Apparently their family home, it's just been uncovered, was the target of a 2009 arson attempt. We are also learning some incredible new information about those missing millions. Four of them, give or take. They were allegedly siphoned by Alex Murdoch from his own law firm and from his dead housekeeper's sons. But if he did it, how did he do it? Attorneys Eric Bland and Ronnie Richter think they know what happened. But first, investigative reporter with WSAV Andrew Davis has the latest on that bizarre arson story that surfaced after more than a decade. Gentlemen, hello to all of you. I'll start with you, Andrew Davis. Tell me it's not so that there is another crime connected to the Murdochs, and this one goes back before all the other ones.
Yeah, 2009 for this one. Michael List is the gentleman's name, and he's accused, according to the reports, of spraying an accelerant around the Murdoch house and trying to light it on fire in a form of an arson. All the way back in July 3rd of 2009, he was picked up just 2 weeks later. The weird thing about this, and tell me if you haven't heard this before, somehow he ends up in the system 3 years later. The case is disposed, but they don't have anything about a sentencing for him. He instead is sentenced for a fraud case where he was defrauding people and apparently not paying some of his own employees. Got 3 years suspended sentence and 4 years probation for that. And now there's another case on the books from 2021 of something very similar. where he's also potentially bouncing checks that are over $1,000 or writing a fraudulent check. So the question that many people have now is, how far back does some sort of scam go or insurance issue go that may be connected to the Murdoch family? Looking at what List did then, could that have been the beginning of something? It wouldn't match the 20-year timetable that his lawyer Harpoonian told us, but it certainly would be well within range of a potential drug issue or even some level of insurance scam.
Well, we're 12 years since 2009, and you know how we were all told that Alex Murdoch's opioid odyssey has been 20. So, I mean, I don't know if that was much ado about nothing or the beginning of something very sinister, but there's a lot to digest there. Just quickly, and I do mean quickly, about a minute left, what do we know anything about the connection between these two people? Like, why on earth would that man have gone to the home, Michael Davis List, at the age of 40 back in 2009? Why would he have gone to their home and lit the mat, the welcome mat on fire with a trail of accelerant going all the way inside and covering all the furniture? Apparently just the mat burned, not the rest of it. But why would he have done that to these people?
Well, that's what you have to understand is we're looking at 12 years back and you're looking at a county that has problems with records and also a lot of paper records then. So we're still trying to dig in exactly, find out what we can about this guy, what exactly his connection to the Murdoch family was and why he might have done this. And then the question would be also why he didn't do any jail time for it, or what exactly did they do when then he had this fraud case on top of it and ended up getting sentenced for that? Was it connected? I'm headed out there tomorrow to exactly find out what may have happened out there and to see if there's something maybe a little bit hinky about what actually happened.
I think hinky would be a very apropos word when it comes to this case. Call me, as I like to say, Andrew Davis, when you continue your investigation tomorrow. Thank you, my friend. I want to turn now to Ronnie Richter and also Eric Bland, two attorneys who are now connected very much into this case through Fellow the Bouncing Ball, the dead housekeeper whose sons were supposed to get $500,000 in a settlement but didn't. And that opened up a big can of worms. And Eric Bland, you joined me on Friday. Your partner's now with us, Ronnie. And you told me that there was a fake company and a bunch of siphoning going to a fake company. Can you give me the Reader's Digest version of how they got that by a judge? Because judges sign off on everything. Why would a judge sign off on this?
Well, we don't know the circumstances of how and when the judge signed off on it. But what they did is they used the name of a company that many lawyers like my partner and me use for structured settlements. And the name of the company is Forge Consulting. And so the company that Alex and Corey Fleming used was the name Forge. They didn't give the full name. And so if lawyers see the name Forge in South Carolina, or a judge was to see the name Forge in our state, they would think that it is a legitimate structure that plaintiff lawyers use to structure a lump sum settlement and pay it out over years after buying an annuity policy. And so
what you're saying is that the name Forge was the name of the, allegedly, the name of the company that Alex Murdoch and his best friend, college roommate, and godfather to his now dead son on the left on this picture, and the man that he set up as the lawyer to his dead housekeeper's sons. You're saying that he created, allegedly, a company called Forge, not Forge Consulting, and had the money sent to the company and then sent the money from the company into a bank account and was basically living the life of Riley?
The money went directly to Corey Fleming, who then sent it to a P.O. box that was established by Alex Murdoch. And Alex Murdoch opened up a bank account in the name of Forge and then took the check that was sent to him directly from Corey Fleming after Corey netted out his attorney fees and then absconded with the money.
So, Ronnie, I'm going to test your mettle from law school here, and I'm hope you can give me the math here and the metrics on the charges. Because if you do things like that, and again, these are allegations, they haven't been proven yet, and he hasn't been charged with this stuff. That's important to point out. But if he is charged, and if he does go down for these kinds of things, that sounds like federal and state, and it sounds for a lot of different things that are different acts that can, you know, can be served consecutively, not concurrently. So what are we looking at here realistically, Ronnie?
Well, Ashley, you know, there would be a veritable potpourri of criminal charges to come out of something like this. Now, that's not really our function. We've been hired by these boys and this family to try to recover that money. But it doesn't take much imagination to realize that criminal charges will likely follow wherever we go. And, you know, one thing that you need to understand is this is Hampton. Hampton, South Carolina is a small town in a small corner of a small state. And the thumbprint of the Murdaugh family in Hampton is very powerful. So, you know, one reason that we keep appealing to the press here and one reason that we were on your show is that we know that there are people in Hampton who know exactly what happened. And so kind of the message tonight is, you know, don't be scared. Come forward. Share what you know with us. Just in the time that we've appealed to the press for information, for evidence, people have come forward. So you'll come to us, share what you know.
Well, tell me more about that. Who has come forward to you about the Murdaughs and with what? You don't have to say names if it's uncomfortable for you, but what kinds of complaints have they had?
Well, we've had
complaints. Go ahead, Ronnie.
Yeah. Go ahead, Ronnie.
Yeah, we've had several calls from potential interested parties with similar stories to tell. Just concerns about what may have happened to their cases, what may have happened to their money. People that believe that they may have been subjected to, you know, similar fraudulent conduct.
Let me get this straight, Eric Bland. Are you saying that there could be additional victims out there who are saying to you that the same thing happened to them that happened to Gloria Satterfield's children?
In a way, that not all the money that was received in a settlement was accounted for, and that they did not get all the information on their case that they should have gotten regarding the resolution. Ashley, the key thing that came out this weekend since we spoke last is that our state law enforcement division made it clear in the state paper that they are expanding this criminal investigation beyond just the death of Gloria Satterfield and what may have caused it, but now are looking into the financial implications and financial potential crimes that happened regarding her settlements, and that the head of SLED said, when we find out what happened, we will hold those accountable. So that is a clarion bell for anybody who is involved, whether it's Corey Fleming, Alex Murdaugh, the personal representative, the banks. The SLED usually doesn't speak. They, if you notice, since the June killings of Maggie and Paul, they haven't said too much. But in the last week, they've announced that they've opened criminal investigations regarding Gloria Satterfield's death and the financial implications of the settlement.
Okay, I want the both of you to hold tight, if you can, for a minute. When we come back after the break, I wanted to ask you a little bit about what Cousin Eddie has been saying. And Cousin Eddie was the man who was arrested alongside of Alex Murdaugh on that alleged conspiracy to, you know, have a fake suicide and get $10 million in insurance money, death insurance money, for the son Buster, who's on your screen. I want to touch on that, but I also want you to finish what you're saying about this, that there could be additional people out there who say something wasn't right with their settlements that Alex Murdaugh represented. Back in a moment. Eric Bland and Ronnie Richter are back with me on the story of the Murdaugh saga and the missing millions. And there may be even more to the story now. Ronnie Richter, can you tell me how many people have reached out to you to say that they think something untowards may have happened with their settlements if they were represented by Alex Murdaugh or Corey Fleming?
No, I can't. So actually, I know you will respect that if people are contacting us, it's in a confidential setting, some with the idea that they might want representation of their own. So I would never reveal who those people are or how many. But I'll tell you that there have been several calls, all of which have legitimacy to them from the stories that were being told. And it is cause for concern. But our hope, however, is that those folks with the knowledge of the Satterfield case will come forward. We know that they're there. We understand, living in a place like Hampton, that these folks are probably leery of the Murdaugh family, and with good reason. But they need to know that they're safe. Come forward. Tell us what happened. Tell us what you know. Go to law enforcement. Share what you know with them. There are people who know exactly how that money was taken from the Satterfield boys.
I'm just so surprised to hear that now there are more people coming forward and asking for some help with regard to that man and his friend, Corey Fleming, another attorney. All right, I'm going to switch gears for 1 minute. Eric Bland, I want to get a comment from you on this just astounding story in the New York Post about Cousin Eddie, Curtis Edward Smith, who was arrested in the alleged conspiracy about that, you know, attempted suicide and the fraud attempt to collect $10 million in life insurance. He said to the New York Post reporter that this was a setup, that he was called out by Alex Murdoch for car trouble. And when he got there, saw Alex waving a gun around. He says he grabbed him. A gun went off and he didn't even wait to see what happened. He took the gun, ran and threw it away. He says he's being set up. What do you make of that story?
Well, you know, I don't know if it's a race to the bottom between Cousin Eddie or Alex, but they are two people that lack total credibility. I say that about another member of our bar, and it doesn't make me happy. But when you're talking about Alex Murdoch, you're talking about five bodies, at least $4.1 million in our case, filing false police report regarding the shooting 2 weeks ago, supposedly trying to pin driving the boat on Mr. Cook and not his son when the beach girl was killed. This man has no credibility at this point. I'm not sure, Uncle Eddie. I haven't studied it. As Ronnie said, we're really only laser focused on the Satterfield case, but it is, it's a three ring circus here. And, I'm doing the best we can just to focus on the Satterfield case because every day something new comes. It's another curveball every day.
Well, Eric Land and Ronnie Richter, I am so thankful for your time tonight. And this is not the last you're going to hear from me. I'm going to be calling you for updates on the client list that may be growing. Thank you to the both of you. Much appreciated.
Thank you for having us on.
Thank you. Thank you, Ashley.
Good evening.
Not the last time. Best to you both. Okay, and I just want to give you a programming note for tomorrow. Of course, we're going to follow what happens overnight with the autopsy. Hopefully, we'll have some results tomorrow with regard to Gabby Petito and the search for Brian Laundrie. Perhaps there'll be a resolution. We'll see you right here tomorrow on Banfield.